This final note before we go today, choose your own adventure, dystopian style. According to Bloomberg, Netflix is developing a series of special TV show episodes where viewers will get to choose how the storyline of a show develops. One of those shows will reportedly be Black Mirror, which honestly sounds terrifying. Also, I read all those Choose Your Own Adventure books as a kid, and I loved them. But you know what? Reacting to situations and making a series of decisions where your character does something and then other characters also do things, that's called real life, and I don't know if I want to watch that.
Marketplace is supported by Progressive Insurance, committed to offering a streamlined shopping experience where home and auto can be bundled together. Now that's Progressive. Learn more at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. And by Baird, providing global financial resources and market expertise to clients the world over. rwbaird.com has more information. And by C3IoT, addressing the world's most challenging problems at the convergence of artificial intelligence, IoT, and elastic cloud computing. More at c3iot.ai.
All right, that's it. We gotta go. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 192 points, nearly 0.75%. The NASDAQ lost 9 points, 0.1%. And the S&P 500 found 10 points, about 0.33%. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, Daisy Palacios, and Phoebe Unterman. Our special projects desk includes Tommy Andres and Eliza Mills. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our wealth and poverty desk. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, in for Kai Rizdahl, and we'll see you all tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
President Trump celebrates a new free trade deal with Mexico and Canada.
We don't take it as a privilege. It's a privilege for them to do business with us. And I'm not talking about Mexico. I'm talking about everybody. Everybody.
But what does that mean as trade wars continue? How trade may be changing. Tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
Morning Edition starts at 4 a.m. on KTOO Juno 104.3.
You're tuned in to KTOO Juno. It's about 7 o'clock. Up next, Focus on Community, followed by Bioneers at 8. Live and local, we're Juno's NPR station 104.3.
Programming support comes from listeners like you and from Michelle Bonnet Hale, running for CBJ Assembly, paid for by Hale for Assembly, Juneau, Alaska.
Good evening. I'm Dr. Elaine Schroeder. Welcome to Mind Over Matter, a monthly K2 radio show that explores issues of the heart as well as of the mind. Tonight's topic has far-reaching implications for how we look at criminal justice as well as how we see our prison system in Alaska. The overriding question is, how do we reduce violence and criminal behavior in our society? Should our prisons be primarily based on the punishment model or the rehabilitation model? What actually works best in terms of recidivism, the rate of former prisoners that return to jail, and what works best for increasing safety for society as a whole? And is there a prison system somewhere in the world that might have the answer to these questions? Well, tonight I'm delighted to have with me in the K2 studio Dean Williams, Alaska's Commissioner of Corrections. Welcome, Commissioner Williams.
Thank you, Elaine. Thanks for having me.
And you're down from Anchorage, and I cannot believe the wonderful coincidence that you're here one night, I think, and I have a live show.
So no, that worked out well.
Yeah,
great.
Thank you so much. Now, I understand that you were part of a delegation that visited prisons in Norway last year, and that the trip had made a strong impression on you. Could you tell me something about
Well, it made an impression on all of us. I took the president of the Senate, Pete Kelly. Yep. I took the Speaker of the House, Bryce Edgemond. I took one of my lead staff, the institution. I took a Superior Court judge, Trevor Stevens from Ketchikan, and one of my superintendents to Norway. This was paid by the Prison Law Office, which is a California law office that's really made most of its living suing the state of California and Nevada and Arizona. And every year they look at promising states and say, hey, we have an opportunity to take your group to Norway to take a look at their prison system. And I jumped at the opportunity. Mostly because of the results I saw out of the Norway system. But it was all paid by the law office in California, and I jumped at the opportunity.
And, you know, to be honest, I've been reading about prisons in Norway in even the popular press and for years. Mm. And I was thrilled to hear that you showed a film called Breaking the Cycle around in Alaska, and hopefully – you will show it here in Juneau.
I'd love to
sometime.
Show it in Juneau. It's a great film.
Okay. It's a terrific film. You spoke to me a little bit earlier and said that if one visited the Norwegian prison system, especially as an American in the corrections field, you couldn't help but be very impressed by what's going on. So could you give us a thumbnail or a description of what is it that they're doing?
Sure. So there's really – here's the main thing that that attracted me, and then I'll kind of give you the peripheral reasons which are a little strong for me. But the main thing is the results out of the Norway and Scandinavian prison system, not just Norway but Sweden, Finland. Actually, Ireland has actually adopted some of the principles as well. But the results are what are compelling. 20 years ago, the Norway prison system was kind of where most of the country was at, relatively high recidivism rates. Recidivism, by the way, for your listeners, is just a reoffense rate that we measure for 3 years out, whether or not someone returns to prison within 3 years. We measure that, and that's kind of a standard time period around the country. So their recidivism rates were ours at right now. About 65%. So ours are about 65%.
Are we in Alaska there?
65? Yeah. No, we're 65%. That's what Alaska is.
Okay.
We're a little bit higher than the rest of parts of the country. But this – we've had that reoffense rate for 20 years inside DOC. And only – we haven't measured before that because our information wasn't very reliable. Yeah.
It's huge.
Right. So 2 out of 3 people released from prison are ended up back in prison within 3 years. Mm. So Norway was where we were at 20 years ago, and they're at about 20% or 25% right now. And so for me, the compelling reason to go was to say, huh, I wonder what they're doing different. And to be real clear, I've never claimed that we're going to make Alaska into Norway or vice versa. But I think when someone gets something right, you have to take a look and ask why and have a curious mind as to why they're getting better results. So for me, it was really around the results that was the primary reason. Mm-hmm. I think it's a good idea to have humane prisons too, by the way, and I think that's the right thing to do. I think that's the moral thing to do, and as a man of faith, I think it's the Christian thing to do in terms of how I run my life. I think it's you have to have things be humane.
Yes. But
really, in addition to that, it's really about the results. So even if you don't believe in any of those other things, you just can't, you're just moved. And I was compelled by the results they were getting out of their prison system.
Yeah. And Why do you think they're getting such good results? What's going on there?
Well, it was they did two white papers that sort of detailed this out and really went through and said, what should we do differently? And they have several principles. A lot of this is not very complicated. It's sort of common sense what you think about it. One of the things they do is they try to do everything they can behind the walls to make things normal for a prison. And the reason why that's a bit mind-blowing, think about what happens right now when someone goes to prison and they lose their freedom. And by the way, I've never debated whether or not someone should lose freedom for committing crimes. I have a home. I have children, grandchildren. I want my community to be safe. In fact, this is all about safety in my mind. Everything about this effort is about improving public safety. When your reoffense rates are so high, this is a fundamental area to go after, right? But one of their principles is just making the prisons more normal. So you cook your own meals. There's one meal provided. You must have a job. You must have a purpose. You must have function behind the walls. And so the reason for that is that if you take someone's freedom away and give them nothing to do, they're not responsible for anything that they're doing, and they're there for 5 years. What happens when you release somebody after where they've never cooked their own meal for 5 years, they've had a job for 5 years, they've never been responsible for a positive pro-social interaction with anyone for 5 years, and it doesn't go well.
You can really change a person's behavior, even if they came in with pro-social skills, good social skills. After numerous years in prison, they would be worse leaving than when they came in.
Right, and that's
– and very angry and traumatized.
Right. Prisons are traumatic places, and I've asked people all the time, what do you – when a person releases from prison, who do you want them to be? Because they're going to be your neighbor. So what kind of neighbor do you want to be? Do you want to have somebody who has a job, who has a purpose in their life, or somebody who's never had a job or doesn't know what to do with themselves, there's too much idle time? Who do you want living beside you? And since 95% of the people in prison today are getting out, in state we release 12,000 people, sentenced people every year. So that's 12,000 people back in your communities, my community too, our communities, who are they going to be? And my goal from day one in this job is to go after the reoffense rate, because I think it's the most profound thing I could do as commissioner to improve public safety.
This is a little out of your purview, but we have certain laws in the United States about felonies and ex-felons and not being able to vote, perhaps not being able to have driver's licenses, and having to fill out – when they fill out an application, having to, if asked, say that they have committed a felony. Are those laws similar in the Nordic states?
Well, I'm not an expert on some of their – I mean, the statutory schemes around the country and around the world are quite different. We incarcerate at a very high rate.
The highest in the world.
Right.
I mean, phenomenal rate. Do you recall the percentage?
Well, it's on a per 100,000 person basis.
That's a better way to do it.
A lot of the Scandinavian countries are – 30, 40, 50, 60, 70, something like that. A lot of European countries, not just Scandinavian countries, but European countries. And we're at about 700.
So sometimes 10 times
the rate of many developed nations.
Yeah. And when I think of that, Commissioner Williams, I think of it from a psychological point of view. I remember when I was volunteering in my children's classroom, I usually would gravitate more towards the troubled kids, the kids who really needed my attention. And it was often a child who had a parent in prison. When I think of our high rates of incarceration, I think of our high rates of children who are growing up without a parent and most likely in poverty, because it's very likely that the breadwinner will be in prison, or at least one of the two breadwinners. It can break up marriages, of course. And so there's always the collateral damage of the child who's outside, or the multiple children who don't have a parent, because that parent is in a system, at least statistically we can see, that is arresting and imprisoning 10 times more people than in countries that are common, similar to us culturally, like Europe. And then these same individuals keep returning to jail at a very high rate. But it has me think of all the damage that occurs because of our high incarceration rate and high recidivism rate.
Well, we, you know, as a state and as a country, of course, we want people held accountable. And different people around the world have different sort of expectations of what accountability might look like. You know, there's a lot of mixed opinions and feelings about whether or not we over-incarcerate or are just about right. And so there's a whole debate around that topic. And I understand, especially if you're a victim of crime, if my house was broken into, I'd want that person held accountable. I want them their freedom taken. But I really – what I've tried to emphasize is I'm all about accountability, and I think we have to have high accountability for people who commit crimes. However, having said that and being real clear about that, you also have to realize that these folks are getting out, and some – and you have to give opportunities for people back to get back to normal again. That doesn't mean everybody's going to take it. Some are knuckleheads, and we're going to be raising them in the prison system, and that happens, and that's the way it goes. Sometimes you can't win. But there are a lot of people, and talk to the parents of children who are in their 20s, who are heroin addicts, who are stealing them blind, stealing their neighbors blind. Yes, they need to be held accountable, but there has to be opportunities to get people back to normal. And that's really a that's the other side of the equation that I've been working on.
You know, I feel that even for, say, I've had my home broken into. And if I were able to sit down with somebody who had a similar experience and thought that retribution was the answer, they wanted that person to suffer. You know, they graffitied their house. They invaded their safe space. I would say, okay, look down the road. Look down the road 20, 30, 40 years. Do you want that person getting out and doing it again? Or do you then want that person rehabilitated and you feel it's they're going to come back to your community. They're from Juneau.
Right.
And I want that person to have a job and to be psychologically better off. And essentially, if it's because of drug abuse and we had drugs stolen, so it really was part of that syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
I want them to have the services to get off the drugs.
Sure. Sure.
And to stay off. So,
no, absolutely. I couldn't agree more.
I think if people understand the long-range implications of a harsh punishment system or a retribution system compared to a rehabilitation system.
Well, I call it a balance system. And I think I've had people approach me in community forums saying, you know, if you just make these prisons really just terrible, horrible, awful places, people want to go there. Here's the problem with that thinking. One, it doesn't work. Two, you get worse results when you make a place that you can imagine. I've had a person in community said, just make these places a hellhole, Commissioner. And I said, respectfully, I disagree with you, and here's why.
And you've got the results, data.
Yeah, because the results are terrible. They've done this, by the way, and you can – there's a whole – look up Pelican Bay, which is a California prison where they put all the gang guys and they kind of made the rules very loose and really going to make it a place of punishment. The results of the place are worse. Violence in the prisons are high. So I say if you don't care about the people even that we're putting in these places, care about the staff that are working there. Because these environments not only impact the people we're putting to serve their sentence in there, they impact the staff. And they make it very difficult and onerous for staff to have a decent working place. And so there's other ways of doing this. So I reject the understandable anger that people have. I get that. I totally get that. But I just reject the conclusion that making a prison a horrible, terrible place is going to make a difference. It's just not – we have tons of research and history of that just not working. That's why you have to have a balance. Accountability, absolutely, but a way back to normal is secondary.
You and I share some background in the juvenile prison system, juvenile jail system. I worked as a social worker in the Seattle Juvenile Jail.
Oh, okay.
And I worked in the girls' unit and while I was in graduate school at University of Washington. And that's how I came up with my dissertation topic, which was working and developing treatment for teenage prostitutes. And one thing I witnessed in the jail in Seattle, and it was a very painful building because it was underground. If you've ever been there, it was really I come out with headaches every day because just the feeling was so counter to my work, which was, you know, to nurture these young they're not young women, nurture these kids who for the most part came from abusive homes. You right. don't run away yeah. from a nice home Did usually.
I oversaw my juvenile career. I actually oversaw the girls' treatment program in McLaughlin. Actually, it was part of my. I was superintendent of that facility. But yeah. It's eye opening to sit down with some of these young ladies and talk about what. How did you get here? What was your life like? What was your life like? And it's pretty horrific stories, traumatic stories. You wonder how they're still alive, and that's. That's the common story, really.
Yeah, and most of the girls who did go into prostitution, told me quite frankly, I'd rather get paid for it than give it away. And what they meant is they're victims of incest
right.
and child sexual
right.
abuse, and
right.
they flee.
Right.
But then the problem in the jail, which at that time, and this is decades ago, so hopefully my fingers are crossed, they've seen the light. There, other than me coming in once a week. On a contract, there were no rehabilitation services for the kids. So what happened is the more, shall we say, innocent or newbies that were in jail were then tutored by the more experienced girls into other forms of criminal activity. And the whole setting there was traumatic for the kids. Mm. So it was a heartbreaking situation. I would imagine that you're experience in Norway has you, it was about a year ago that you were
right.
there,
mm-hmm.
and has that inspired any programs in Alaska?
When you come back, you size these to okay, what can we start and how is it going to work here, and let's try something. So we in our Kenai facility, actually, that superintendent, Shannon McLeod, I'll give her a shout out. She's a great superintendent. She went to Norway with me. Pardon me. She came back, started a component of that program that we saw in Norway, and it's a very simple program, but it's really just assigning prisoners to officers and having time and encouraging 15, 20-minute conversations during the course of the work week and developing purposeful interactions. And in Norway, they do this like crazy. They're very strategic about every interaction they have with a prisoner, about what they're doing, about how they're modeling behavior. And it changes the dynamic inside the walls. And so we've been at that for about 6 or 7 months in Kenai. I think Shannon is starting to see results, so there's less incidents there. We're still waiting to kind of really see how it rolls out. I think staff were a little suspicious. Don't blame them, right? Oh, what's this new idea?
All of a sudden, it's a whole new paradigm.
Right. But we have a lot of staff who are already leaning, who realize that the role, I think, of the correctional officer should be much larger than it has been, much more important, much more key to the operation. And that's the way it is. I've thought that the first day I got the job. But that was also reinforced in Norway as well. Prison officers, they call them prison officers there, are trained extensively. They're given responsibilities for behavior change and interactions. And so it's a very strategic. And we have great officers who get this, and they just need to be launched. And so we've started that program in Kenai, and I think we're seeing some positive signs already.
Oh, that's wonderful. And what a better place to work. When I saw the movie Breaking the Cycle, I was really struck by just the body language and the appearance of the prison officers in Norway compared to our correctional officers here in Attica Prison. And I might mention to those of you who are listening, you can watch this film. You just Google Breaking the Cycle, and I watched the whole thing. It lasts maybe 45 minutes.
50 minutes, yeah.
50, mm-hmm. yeah, 50 minutes. And I just watched it this week, and it's extraordinary. And you take a look at how the guards look. I'm going to call them guards, but prison officers at Attica Prison, famous prison for dangerous offenders, and then their counterparts at Halden Prison in Norway, which also is their high security prison.
Right.
And you see the correction officers in Norway, they look relaxed. Actually, they look like they really love their jobs.
They do.
And, I mean, the jobs are very rewarding. And the correction officers at Attica looked totally stressed out and angry. And you know what that does to your blood pressure and to your longevity. I mean, it's really bad for your health. Also, I might add that people are attracted to jobs. It's pretty obvious. Good people are attracted to good jobs. And so if you have an environment that is rewarding and is a more upbeat place to work and they feel satisfaction, these are the workers at the prison, you're going to get a higher caliber correction officer.
Well, I would say also I talked to staff and I talked to correctional officers at the time about how we make the table bigger, right, for many different kinds of people to work in this department and to have many different personalities and from different backgrounds. So if you're kind of a more social worky kind of person, you have a place in this department. Pardon me. And I think we do.
Yeah.
But if you're also a little bit more on the police-minded enforcement piece, we want you at the table too.
Yeah.
The goal in this department is creating multiple opportunities and multiple venues. That's the same way that I have been moving the prisons. So not everyone. There are some people, by the way, as I said before in my talks, that need to be in a cell block, need because they're dangerous.
Yeah.
But there's a bunch of people that need to do time. We have their freedom, but they need to be very productive. They don't need to be sitting in a cell block. They need to be having a job. They need to be reason to get up in the morning. You cannot have idle hands in a prison system.
Yeah.
And so it's very important that you keep people occupied and people moving.
Okay. I think it's time to take a short music break. And then Commissioner Dean Williams and I will be back in a few minutes to talk some more about what the new paradigm for prisons. So hold on and we'll be back.
I hear something saying, that's the sound of the men working on the chain gang. That's the sound of the men working on the chain gang. All day long they're saying, ooh, ah, ooh, ah, ooh, ah, ooh, ah. That's the sound of the men working on the chain gang. That's the sound of the men working on the chain gang. All day long they work so hard till the sun is going down, working on the highways and byways and wearing a frown. You hear them moaning their lives away, then you hear somebody say, that's the sound of the men working on the chain gang. That's the sound of the men working on the chain gang. Can't you hear them saying, I'm going home one of these days. I'm going home, see my woman whom I love so dear. But meanwhile, I've got to work right here. That's the sound of the men working on the chain gang. That's the sound of the men working on the chain gang. All day long they're saying, my, 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 my. My work is so hard, give me water, I'm thirsty, my work is so hard, oh, oh, my.
Welcome back. to Mind Over Matter. With me in the studio tonight is Dean Williams, who is the Commissioner of Corrections in Alaska, and he's down here from Anchorage. We've been discussing his impressions of the Norwegian prison system, which he visited last year, and its successes in reducing their recidivism rate and what improvements can be made in Alaska prisons. And Commissioner Williams, one thing you mentioned earlier is that to get this this study trip of the Norwegian prison system, you were chosen because you were Alaska was a promising state. Now, why did they think we were promising?
Well, I'm paraphrasing. Well, I think they would say that I guess we were promising. They're picking states that certainly are going through change processes in their prison system and who are looking forward to improving results. That's really the bottom line. If they're going to invest that kind of money into a state because it's taking us all over there. They took us and the state of Oregon. We both went last year. They wanted to be sure that you were serious about looking at changing results. And I came into this job to make prisons safer mm-hmm. for prisoners and especially also for staff. And to get better results. And I detailed that, what we were looking at. And I won't go into all the history and the problems, but we've had very old policies. And I just said, let's take a look. Actually, Senator Kelly asked me not long after I was confirmed as commissioner. He said, hey, is there anyone doing right? And I said, I don't know if there is or not. But we should take a look. And I was at a meeting, national meeting, and I heard about this a program that they were sending states. And like I said before, that's why I jumped at the opportunity.
I bet you're glad you did. And I'm really – we're all really glad you did. A criminologist that I was reading about in preparation for our show tonight said prison should have five goals. And the criminologist's name is Bob Cameron. Retribution, incapacitation, deterrence, restoration and rehabilitation. And then he went on to say, Americans want their prisoners punished first and rehabilitated second. So what do you think about that?
Well, the Norwegians have a saying which I have adopted is that I want punishment that works and I want punishment that makes sense and I want punishment that gets results. Mm-hmm. And if you don't – if you're doing punishment that doesn't work, if you're having someone come into the system and comes out angrier, more violent, more hostile, more down than when they went in, what are we accomplishing? So this is not just the mantra of having humane prisons for me. This is really the mantra of making a system where that punishment works and at the end of the day you reduce violence for people coming out because you've made an environment that is rehabilitative but instructive in nature and also accountable in nature, full accountability. If you screw up in the Norway prison system, you're in trouble. You go right back to square one. They're not fooling around in terms of any of those things. And I would not never wave from that either. However, they provide opportunities in different ways. And so as long as it's punishment that works and gets the results, I don't think you can argue with that because if any of us have been a victim, you know, you're hoping that someone else doesn't go through the same thing. And I can't impact any of the past people who have been victims of crimes. I have people very close to me who have been victims of crimes, my wife, for example, and I want those people held accountable too, but you hope that somebody else doesn't go through the same thing you went through. And most victims would agree, dear Lord, let's try to do something so somebody else doesn't become a victim in the future. And that we can influence. We can't control the whole thing, but we certainly can influence and try to get a system where punishment does work.
You know, all cultures have key belief systems, and they were talking about the Nordic worldview. And do you think our worldview in America has more to do with spare the rod and spoil the child, a belief system that harsh punishment, obviously a rod is physical harsh punishment. We know from child development that that does not it does not do well for the child to have harsh physical punishment. In fact, we call it abuse. And if a person wasn't incarcerated, I know that abuse is not allowed technically in prisons, but the way prisoners may be treated sometimes, if they were in another setting like a hospital, it would be seen as abusive and harsh. And that kind of behavior obviously reinforces the kind, the likely kind of harsh reality that these prisoners faced while they were growing up. And, you know, you worked in a juvenile facility as I did. And the vast majority of people I know, who kids who ended up in this facility, came from abusive homes. And I would extrapolate and assume, and you probably know the data, that the vast majority of people who are in the adult prison system come from very difficult homes, even homes where a parent was incarcerated, and the cycle continues and continues.
Yeah, well, add on to that, that's all that is true, but add on to that the opioid crisis that this state and those states are facing too, where you now have perfectly fine families, and I meet them all the time and talk to them all the time, who have a son or a daughter who now is a heroin addict, whose now mind is taken over, and the addiction of heroin.
Yes.
There's a lot of addictions that are really, really bad. So don't get me wrong, but there's something particularly hideous about heroin addiction. I think it really robs a person's will. It is really a horrible thing. Talk to family members. So all of those things are true, and I think you know, the heroin addiction has added another level of sort of trouble to some of our incarceration systems.
And so, you know, these would be people who really, if they had proper treatment and proper care in a prison system, the reason they got in was because of addiction. And they grew up with a solid family base.
Right.
Their rehabilitation would be of the utmost priority, because you could harm them in a harsh prison system. They could come out worse than they went in and more likely to become addicted to drugs, which is really meeting emotional needs with drugs.
Right. Well, it's maybe no surprise to some of your listeners that if you're a heroin, if you're an addict on the outside of the walls, you're an addict on the inside of the walls too. And so part of our some of our sources of problems behind the walls are drug trafficking behind the walls. And because with idle time and without productive treatment behind the walls and productive engagement and jobs behind the walls, you're an addict looking for drugs behind the walls now.
And what kind of treatment is there?
Well, there's substance abuse treatment that we have through different contracts. There's actually a new program, speaking of heroin, that we started a little over a year ago. We call Vivitrol Behind the Walls for people who are getting out and released. We're doing a research. Actually, University of Fairbanks is doing a research on this effort. It's been done around the country, where Vivitrol, just real briefly, is a drug that interferes so you can get high while you're on Vivitrol. It's an old drug to actually use for alcohol addiction, but it actually works for heroin as well. So we're trying some innovative ideas like that in terms of doing Vivitrol behind the walls before people get out. So we do screening, do medically, look at their history, and get somebody on that course. So that's one way of dealing with getting once people are behind the walls of how we're dealing with some of the heroin addiction for people getting out. And that's been, like I said, going on for a little over a year.
Could you tell us any other programs? I know, because I've interviewed people about Lemon Creek. And they have a garden program there, and they have people coming in. Because you that's been going on for quite a while, hasn't it?
Well, the garden we've expanded it this year, though. We're doing more this year. They've laid out a whole open – they didn't plant potatoes this summer, but next year they say they are. They get the soil right. But we've expanded that recently. That's an example of some of the things also behind the walls that we're really expanding on in terms of just gardening and productive activities. It sounds small. It's not. We do it at Highland. We have a plant sale every spring. Kenai, they've expanded this program. So it's things like that that are maybe not big in scope, don't really cost hardly any money.
Yeah.
And it engages people behind the walls in productive activities. So a small thing, but a big thing.
What about volunteers? Do you have any – in Juneau, I know there's a volunteer program that
right.
people have gone in to teach different skills, to teach meditation, to teach whatever. And, of course, the secondary aspect of that is that they get – the people inside the walls get social contact with people outside the walls.
Exactly.
And frequently what I found with the girls I was working with in the juvenile jail was that they had little contact – with healthy adults, so growing up, because they were surrounded by a dysfunctional family, and then the neighborhood would be very poor, and they'd be really have never met a normal. I was working with girls, so they had never met a successful woman, a woman that they might want to emulate.
Sure.
And so I would assume that the volunteers coming in are forming brief. Not very deep, but still important relationships with prisoners.
You're really onto something here. So I thought this was important before I went to Norway, but it just confirmed my intuition and the research on this as well. I have opened up, and all credit to my superintendents and all my staff. When I say I, it's really all them. Mm-hmm. When I say I mean other people are actually doing the work. And so they have really opened – I have really given freedom to the superintendents to open their facilities up in terms of having outside people coming in. That's actually what Norway would be the import model, which means import your services from the outside as much as in as you can. And so we've done that more. We have a whole a whole program of now vetting volunteers coming behind the walls, and they get a little green badge, and it really identifies them in the system as, oh, you're kind of actually one of us now, aren't you? You're actually here for a purpose. The staff understand who they are. It's very clear, and so we treat them like one of us, like one of our staff. And I think that's really, really important for all the reasons you just mentioned, that you want people to from the outside to have to as many positive relationships with people who are due to get out anyhow versus if you talk to heroin addicts, you know, some of the first people they call getting out of prison are the drug dealer because they've burned up every other relationship by virtue of their addiction.
Yes.
And so people from the outside coming in, hugely important. Faith component, faith organizations. We have a fantastic group of volunteers, hundreds of volunteers
yes.
every week go into our prison systems, and I've expanded. I have a great chaplain, Chaplain Duncan, who runs that program. And so we have many people from the faith community, nonprofits, recovery groups mm-hmm. who come in. And so by the way, here in Juneau, we have a great superintendent in Bob Cordell. He's a great man, and if you're interested, get a hold of them. If you have something to offer that facility, Lemon Creek is your facility, not mine, and it's and there are opportunities. We continue to expand opportunities about how people come in, and for reasons they come in, and we vet you, and we give you a card. We're like, okay, you're one of ours now. We know who you are, and we get you on a schedule, and so. Yeah, it's really, really important. All those things impact the reoffense rate. All of those things are going to make us all safer. That's the bottom line.
Well, you're normalizing, and I think some people may say, well, we don't want it normalized. You know, they should suffer. But by normalization, it means preparing them for life outside.
Right.
And normalization in, for example, in the particular Norwegian high security prison, they had a music room and people could play music and record music. Now – you really want somebody when they get out to have something that they can do to entertain themselves, a hobby, even if it doesn't become a career.
Right.
So the idea that punishment alone is going to deter somebody from reoffending doesn't make sense at all.
It certainly doesn't make sense if you're a heroin addict, I can tell you that, because you've thrown all caution to the wind if you're down that road. So normalizing activities, normalizing relationships, all those things are ways to pull people back from where they're at.
Do you have any job programs? Any or is this only in halfway houses?
Well, Elaine, I'm so glad you asked about this because this is one of my favorite topics that I'm not sure many people know about. But this year we have started a program that we call TWO, which is Transitional Work Opportunity. And for several years in Kenai, we had prisoners actually going to seafood processors, working during the day, coming back to the prison at night. However, I've pushed this program out in full partnership with seafood processors. So this year, instead of them having come back to prison, we had prisoners working at the Kenai facility. Pacific Star is a company who had 18 prisoners, 16 men, 2 women. And they worked through the whole season without incident. We expanded it to the town of Cordova. We did great this season. A couple of the guys got in trouble right at the end, but it was in kind of areas that we kind of expected. A lot of it has to do with drinking or falling off the wagon or drugs or things like that. And we kind of knew that that was going to come. That was a new community, but the chief of police was working with us. We're actually in conversations with, believe it or not, Dutch Harbor. The community there. And so we're still working through that. I was just there last week meeting with the city council and the mayor and the chief. And they're interested. They're trying a pilot project there. So why would we do this, right? Well, let me – you didn't ask, Elaine, but let me tell you.
That's my next question. How's it working out? Why did you do it?
Yeah, well this is particularly appropriate for seafood processors who – I don't know if your listener is aware of this, but there are hundreds of jobs, thousands of jobs every year that we're bringing in from not just out of state but out of country.
I know. I've run into these
And
folks.
No disrespect to the seafood processors because they need to have a job done, right? I totally get that. But we have – guess what? So I tell the processors, we have people behind the walls who need a job, who need a second chance, who you – if you hire them, you get a tax credit for hiring them. We will monitor them. We will keep tabs on them because they're still serving out their prison sentence. If they have any kerfuffle at all, any problems at all, they come straight back to prison. But guess what? People behind the walls understand what a huge opportunity it is. So they make a prevailing wage like everybody else that works there. They pay for their meals there. We keep them on electronic monitoring to help keep track of them. We do drug testing of them and everything else under the sun. And we're starting to show very good results. So it's really the most promising. It shouldn't be. So this year we had maybe 30 people, 35 people in the program. We hope to double it to PacStar. They just told my superintendent next year they hope to double. They want double or triple of what they had there. And the reason why – so this is the – talk to the companies. If nobody believes me, but the companies say they're the best workers, best behaved. because they have a lot riding on this. And if there's any mess up or any trouble, they lose the opportunity of being there. And so here's the other thing about this program. And they're making a prevailing wage. We do a sort of there's a percentage where they are required to save and they're not outspending money. So they are saving money for when they get out.
Yes.
They pay restitution. If there's restitution, we make them pay a bit of their restitution. If there's child support, back child support. So they're giving back and making amends for what they did, if there's anything financial associated with what they did. And it gives and when they get done, and we've had workers already who have stayed on. This year we had workers who have stayed on with the company.
After they're released?
After they're released.
Oh, how fabulous.
So
they have a job right away.
Right. And they have a reference right away. So the company now has become a job source for them or a reference for them. And so that you can't. That's probably one of the best public-private partnerships I've been involved with.
It's actually brilliant. It can't be replicated in other states.
It can't be.
Unfortunately, we've got the seafood processors, and I was well aware because out by Auk Bay, I remember seeing a whole bunch of folks working on fish processing. And they were from all over the world,
right,
on a particular type of visa that had them come in.
Right.
And it makes much more sense to train our people who are going to be our neighbors,
right,
and who are going to stay here.
There are some of these,
and pay taxes.
You know, there's some of these plants that are out in remote locations. I've lived here for almost 37 years. I had no idea where these locations are at. They're remote locations. There's one out by Dutch Harbor, 1,500. It's about 40 miles from Dutch Harbor. 1,500 people work at that. It's a small city.
Wow.
1,500. It's unbelievable. I mean, there's a whole other story you can do about people. This is a fishing community in many ways along southeast Alaska, but they do like 3 million pounds of pollock in one day. And so you have to have a whole army of people to process this. And why not focus on having Alaskans, right, who need a second chance, who need a job when they get out? It really is a perfect match. So we're going slow, strategic, carefully, and the companies have just been great, and we're just going very slow right now. But I really think there's a future in this for our state, and I really think this is a way of reducing the reoffense rate and, oh, by the way, getting Alaskan workers working in Alaskan jobs.
Yeah. And what happens in general if somebody's released from prison? Are they just given a bus ticket and you say bye-bye? What is – are there services to prepare the person? Because what if somebody just walks out of prison and they're in Juneau and they walk out of Lemon Creek, but they're from Fairbanks,
right,
or they're from Nome, or they're from Bethel? What happens? I mean, it just seems – is there a difference in our system compared to, say, Norway? Does Norway have a different way?
Well, they're very strategic about making sure that people have a job and have a place to live on the way out. I think I was hearing your producer play the Shawshank Redemption. I joke about with people about that movie, that even as jacked up as that prison was in that movie, they did one thing right. When the people were getting out, they had a job and a place to live. And I think that's really part of why our reoffense rate is so high. So you cannot release somebody out. And does it happen in our system? It does. It does. And that's what troubles me. There are people – like we pay for their return to their place of arrest. And if they've served all their time and we don't have any more stronger sort of incentives or hooks on them, they're back in your community and they're walking the streets. And it's not good.
So they will be on the streets.
Right. So
unless they have the great good fortune of having somebody who isn't mad at them for being in jail or committing a crime and wants to take care of them.
They're homeless. And that's part of our homeless problem too, even in Anchorage. If you look at that, they're really the most chronic homeless people in Anchorage are people who migrate between homeless shelters, on the streets, hospitals, and prisons. And so they're kind of the frequent flyers. Those are kind of the harder ones to sort of reach. But there's a lot of others who, if they had a place to live and had a job, you would automatically, just on that alone, would increase their chances of a successful reentry.
Yes.
And there was a gentleman in Dutch Harbor, which I loved hearing his comment on this. He goes, well, Commissioner, you're kind of stopping short, aren't you? Don't they need some follow-up treatment services? And I said, absolutely, sir, they do. But unless we have those two first things in place, the third one isn't going to make any difference, because you have to have those two before you're worried about showing up. Where you're going to sleep and what you're going to eat are pretty basic needs.
And I recall reading in the Juneau Empire, that Anchorage now has apartments. They're doing – I don't know if you'd call it an experiment, but apartments for people who have been inebriated on the streets. And it was citing the research to show that if you give somebody housing, that they're much more likely to go into treatment and to sustain their sobriety.
Yeah, I think that model's called Housing First.
Yes.
And here's what I know about that group, and I'm familiar with the program. I don't claim to have a great deep insight into how it works, or I'm aware that the research says it's better, and I know it's because one of the reasons is that these people are very expensive. We pay for these folks, and by emergency room visits, by police our emergency services are tied up with these individuals. So if you can just pull a few of them off of the frequent flyer list, you've really made an impact in freeing up your emergency services. And certainly we see these people coming in out of prison on a frequent flyer basis as well. And so I commend all those out there who are working on the homeless issue because I'm kind of brothers with them on with what I'm doing in terms of the reoffense rate because you reduce the reoffense rate when we can get these people off the streets, and that's why I'm very supportive of homelessness efforts because it's certainly right up my alley as the commissioner.
Yes, yes. Now, we have a few minutes left, and what I want to do is find out, in the best of all possible worlds, what programs would you like to institute in our prison system in Alaska?
Well, one I mentioned, and that is I think there are ways for people to do their sentence different. And I mentioned one, which is, look, I'll give you an option. So if you have a year to do because I have your freedom, as the department has your freedom for a year, I can give you an option to say, how do you want to do your time? Do you want to do it in a cell block? Do you want to do it in a cell? And if that's your choice and your behavior or your behavior is bad, you do your time there. And so that should be an option for people. Mm-hmm. However, if you're saying, well, gee, you have the department has my freedom for a year, maybe I should go actually go through treatment. I should get a job. Maybe I should make a wage while I'm serving my time because I'll tell you where you can work at. I mean, so there's still restrictions on this. I still have control of your freedom. But I think there's other ways that people can do their time. I'm starting to work with communities, by the way. I'm going to Valdez actually on Thursday to meet with the chief. We've recently started a program there. So this is a second way, which I think is the future for this department. And that is to do what I'm calling community sentencing. So a lot of times the people from small communities, someone has a 60-day sentence or a 90-day sentence, and maybe they need to come to prison in an urban area. That's totally fine. But what if that community wants to have them serve their sentence there? And so I'm not selling this to the communities. I'm just giving them the opportunity. And so I have said to those communities, you know what? I'll pay you a little bit of money because I've saved some money back for this program. If you take them, put them on electronic monitoring, you control their movements, you have them home on a curfew, you decide how you want them to do the sentence in your community. And if they can do 60 or 90 days, then that's an intermediate sanction before they go to prison. And I have communities who are warmly embracing this. I have Cordova, who I think is going – the chief has signed on with me already. I have Valdez, who signed on with me already. I was just mentioning I was in Unalaska and Dutch Harbor. I talked to that chief. I think she's going to sign on with me. And you can imagine the savings we would get as a state, not to mention trying to avoid a disruption of jobs. So you say you have somebody who really has, you know, some time coming to them, 60 days, 90 days. Not anything too serious, but they have a sanction. They can come to prison. We fly them in. We fly them back. It takes troopers or somebody else to do it. And so I think those are the kind of ideas that I think are real promising. And the chiefs have been very open to me about it. I have more chiefs interested in this program. And so then I'm paying them a little bit to keep them there. The state saves the money.
Yeah.
We save trooper and my staff transport costs of flying these people back and forth. There's hazards in that. And, oh, by the way, maybe that person can stay in their job while we have them on electronic monitoring in that community. Not appropriate for everybody. And I would like to repeat, I'm really having the community run this and really tell us if they want people to stay in their community. If they do, I'm going to help support them as the department. Not a lot of money, but a lot cheaper than flying them back and forth and housing them in a very expensive bed in Lemon Creek or other facilities that cost about $150, almost $160 a day per person. Mm. So you can see why I think that's a very sensible strategy for it's in the best interest of the state financially, as well as holding someone accountable and yet giving them opportunity to stay at their job and renormalize.
Is there any coincidence that the communities that have shown interest in having this program are the very ones, it seems, that have the fish processing guys coming? Because once the idea of this is a criminal, and then there's the police department has experience with working with inmates who are now working in fish processing and having a positive experience with that, that may bleed over into their desire to have more community-based work.
I don't think it's a coincidence. I think some of those communities understand that those people are coming back to them. And if we can keep them in the community and have a job, the better off we're all going to be.
Thank you. And that's a wonderful note to end on. I really appreciate you coming in and spending your evening in beautiful Juneau with all our wonderful restaurants here. I hope you get to go out to dinner.
My pleasure.
Okay, thank you. And so I want to thank Dean Williams, Alaska's Commissioner of Corrections, for sharing his insights about improving Alaska's prison system and making our communities as a whole safer. And I really want to thank you for your compassion and your openness and your desire to make prisons more humane and more effective.
Right.
And I'd like to thank Shelley Delaney, who has been my producer tonight, and for her support for this show. And, of course, thanks to all our listeners for tuning in. Please join us for another edition of Mind Over Matter on another Monday evening next month. Good night.